This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last couple of weeks have been about terrible things like Averroes and Yisurim and all sorts of miserable things like that, but it just seems to be hard to go. So don't let it depress you. Don't let it depress you. It's part of heaven. One needs to know and understand it. And this basically Yisurim can help you in the inevitable battles that everybody experiences every day, to try and do what they would really like to do and not to do what they really wouldn't like to do, then it's certainly good. And if it just gives you a certain understanding of what an Avera is and how it operates, it's also good. All I'm saying is don't start thinking that there's nothing in the Torah besides Avera in your children, as some people do think. I'm going to start off with a question that has got nothing to do with the Seder. The question appears many times in the Torah. It appears with Paro. Paro believes in God, accepts God, talks about God, asks Moshe to be Misparo to God, to ask the things to stop, the place to stop, all sorts of things. He accepts the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he behaves like Paro. Strange. Bilam. Bilam says, in Yitain Balak, in Yitain Li Balak, in the Lord they talk case of the God, if Balak will give me a house full of silver and gold. And you can imagine what kind of house Balak lived in. Not like our houses. When Bilam said a house full of silver and gold, he meant Balak's house full of silver and gold. Even if he'll give me a palace full of silver and gold, lo ucha lava is bidra Hashem, I can't bear over anything that the Ribbono Shel Olam said. Tzaddik. An absolute tzaddik. And look what he goes and does. And how he behaves. Very strange. And very often we find in Tanakh reassuring Jewish ones and non-Jewish ones. We don't question the Ribbono Shel Olam. But still they behave the way they do. You'll find in the Gemara many times the various apikusim argue with the Chachomim and they try and prove their apikusis from the Torah. They bring psukim and they interpret that you can read it this way and that way, and they try and bring proof from the Torah itself that they are right to be apikusim. What's the point? One can never understand this. And if you're an apikoros, why are you bringing sticking from the Torah? And if you accept the Torah, how can you be an apikoros? And this conflict exists very often. We're used to thinking that somebody who believes in God is a Frum Jew. I mean, he really believes in the Ribbono Shel Olam, clearly. And anybody who isn't a Frum Jew obviously doesn't have a clear emunah. He doesn't really clearly believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam, but we see that it's not like that. That's the first question. Second question comes from a section in the parasha, which we did in the Lady Shul this morning. In the middle of nowhere, after talking about some of the complicated aspects of the korbanos that apply to Shabbos, the lechem aponim on Shabbos and so on, the Torah tells us, Vayetze ben isha Yisraelis, Vahu ben ish Misri, the first b'nei Yisrael, a son of a Jewish woman and an Egyptian man, so his father was Egyptian, his mother was Jewish, went out into the community. He went out into the community. Vayinotsu b'machane ben ha-Yisraelis v'isha Yisraelis. And this son of the Jewish woman had an argument with another Jewish man. Vayikrov ben ha-isha ha-Yisraelis et Hashem. And the son of the Jewish girl mentioned God's shame on the Torah, the special name of God which we don't ever mention, by a kalel and then he cursed it, by a viyoso Moshe, and they brought him to Moshe. The shame imer Shlomis bas Bizi lemate Don, and the name of his mother was Shlomis bas Bizi from the tribe of Dan. By Yenisu, by Mishma, and they kept him in locked up, Lifresh lohem ma'piya, alpiya Hashem, until they will be, have it explained to them by God what needs to be done with him. And God spoke to Moshe, saying, take him out of the camp, and all the people who heard it should put their hands on his head, and then the whole community will stone him. That does not mean that the whole community stones him. We never do such things. Stoning was carried out in a very different way to the way it's normally pictured. He was taken up to a building. He was pushed over the side of the building by the two witnesses who came to give evidence about him. And usually that killed him. If it didn't, they used to drop one heavy stone or two until that would be in. It wasn't a whole crowd of people throwing stones at him until he died. Nothing as barbaric as that. But still is not a pleasant way to die. Nobody pretends that it is. It's the worst of the four death sentences. And it's a little bit difficult to understand why this man should get such a terrible sentence. He curses God's name, that's a terrible thing. Chorus, maybe. He gets some kind of punishment from heaven. But that Beis Din has to carry out a capital punishment, a death sentence on this man, a little bit difficult to understand. What did he do? I was taught when I was very small to say that sticks and stones can break my bones and words cannot harm me. I was much older when I learned that was a lie. When words can harm you more than sticks and stones. But that's what they teach the children to say. Among the various other nonsense and lies that they teach them to believe. However, for the Ribbono Shel Olam, at least it's true. What does God care if somebody curses him? What difference does it make? Does he care that much that we have to administer capital punishment to the man who cursed him? I'm a sugar man. So we'll have to understand why the severity of the punishment. And then the whole parasha reads very strange. A man went out who was the daughter of a Jewish lady. Doesn't mention her name yet. I mean, this would be the time. If we're going to hear her name, surely here it should say it. No. Jewish girl and an Egyptian father. And the son of the Jewish girl argued with a Jewish man. We're not told what the argument was about, although Chazal do tell us. And he's referred to all the time as the son of the Jewish woman. And that's strange because everybody there was sons of Jewish women. What made this man unique was the fact that he was the son of an Egyptian man. But it doesn't refer to him again as being the son of the Egyptian man. Son of the Jewish woman. And then he curses God and they bring him to Moshe. At the end of the story it tells us the name of his mother, which Shlomi Tzad Divri, to the tribe of Dan. Now it's clear that all the information we're given in this little parsha is given to us to help us understand the nature of this particular Avera, what it is in fact that he did wrong, and why it is that he received this particular punishment. There can't be one piece of information which is irrelevant to that. And therefore we have to go through these facts. We have to understand the fact that he was the son of an Egyptian man, that he was a son of an Egyptian woman, of a Jewish woman. And we must understand all these, and that she's from the tribe of Dan. Everything that the Torah tells us about him must be telling us in order to understand this little episode clearly. Let's start off understanding his background a little bit. Rashi says that what brought him to do this terrible thing is because of his mother. And that's why it stresses who his mother was. Tosfos says that it's because he's from the tribe of Dan. And the Sipunu says it's because his father was an Egyptian. All in all, he didn't have a very illustrious background. And it's this background which seems to play a big part in understanding what he did and why he did it, and it's this background which we have to understand. Rashi and the Tosfos and the Sipunu. Let's start off understanding the fact that he came from the tribe of Dan. Now the place to try and understand the unique qualities of each tribe is in Bereishis, where Yaakov gives his blessings to the various tribes and puts his finger on their various qualities. What does he say about Dan? Don Yodin Amoy Ka'achad Shifte Yisroel. Firstly, we're told that Dan, it uses the word Yadin, which means will judge, will involve himself in law. But that's not the way that the Mefoshim understand the literal translation of Yadin here. Dan will take revenge on behalf of the tribes of Israel. Yehi Dan nochash alei derech. May Dan become a snake in the road. Shifon alei oira. Shifon is a particularly bad kind of snake. In the passageway. Hanoyshech ikvei sut, one who bites the ankles of horses, vayipol rochvei achor, and their riders fall over backwards. Vishuotcho kivisi Hashem, I pray for your salvation, Hashem. That's what the Yaakov says about Dan. Very strange, this intonation of a Nachash. We talked last night, and I'm going to have to repeat some of what we said last night, about the qualities of a Nachash. Is the Yetzer Hara, is Lashon Hara, all sorts of terrible things with Nachash. We don't normally find the Nachash referred to in any kind of glowing terms. And here Yaakov picks out what quality in Dan? May he be a snake in the road, biting the ankles of horses, so that their riders can fall over backwards. Doesn't seem very nice. The Gemara says in Sochim Daf Dalet that you can recognize what tribes people come from by the way they behave. The characteristics of each tribe are so ingrained that they pass from parents to child for generations and generations, forever and ever, and you can actually pick it out at a much later stage. For example, says the Gemara, if somebody comes to you and always says, let's go to court, let's take this to the lawyers, let's not argue you and I, let's go to the law, then you know he comes from Dan. And the Gemara learns it out from the first part. As I said, the literal translation, the way the Mephoshim takes Dan Yadin, means that Dan will take revenge on behalf of Yisrael. But you see, the Gemara in Sochim learns also that he has a certain tendency to want everything to be settled by the law. And the next thing, two things are told about him. So one is that he's this law-orientated person, and that he will take revenge. And the second thing is that he's a snake. Now, it's often thought that wanting to take everything to law is a sign of strength. It means I'm satisfied that the law is on my side, otherwise I wouldn't suggest it. It's actually a sign of tremendous weakness. I always want to take things to the Lord. It means it's most similar to a child who says, if you don't stop doing it, I'll tell my daddy. I mean, I'm incapable of sorting out the problem myself, but I have somebody much bigger at home who can come and sort us out. That's a little bit what going to the Lord is. We can't sort it out ourselves. We can't negotiate. We can't discuss. We can't compromise. Let's go to court. They'll do. And you have the kind of people who will not be prepared to accept anything unless the court is imposing. Even though they might be able to negotiate a much better solution than the court will impose, they feel happier if it comes from the court. They're not out on their own. That's the way it is. It's a certain insecurity among people. Certainly there are times when the other party just won't see sense. One has to go to court. The courts are there to serve a very important function. But we're talking about an extreme case of a man who's always going to court. Never can settle anything out of court. Whenever he has a problem, he's ready to run to the magistrate. And that kind of person is actually a person who's a little bit insecure. He doesn't feel strong enough to be able to solve his problems in confrontation, to talk to a person directly, to handle it and so on. What happens when such a person fails in law? Either because the law went against him, or because the other party won't go to law. So he can't use law, and he doesn't have the stature and the confidence to negotiate the thing up front. What is he left for him to do? He's got to start playing nasty. That's the only thing he can do. He's got to start playing politics. Politics, this type of politics, is a type of politics which has become very prevalent today. Nixon wasn't challenged by any great politician on some major matter of principle. It was a whole sort of, I don't know what you call it, a bunch of dogs. What do you call it, a whole clan of dogs? A pack of dogs. A pack of little puppies. A pack of little fox terriers went after him. Nobody stood out in front and challenged him. Little fox terriers. And what did they do? Bring him down. That's politics. Bring the enemy down. We can't get up there to confront him. He's too big for us. So bring him down. That's politics. And the information affair in South Africa, and all the various different scandals, the name of modern politics has become scandal. Find a scandal about your enemy, play it right, and bring him down. And it's not you. You're the honest, righteous person who just pointed out to the public what a scoundrel they had for the leader. That's all you're doing. You bite the horse. You don't even bite the man. You can't reach to his ankle. Nowhere near. You can't come anywhere near his ankle. But anybody can bite the horse's ankle. No, not anybody can bite the horse's ankle. You have to be pretty low down to be able to bite the horse's ankle. And that's the politician. When he hasn't got the self-confidence to confront and to negotiate and deal, and he doesn't have the stature to stand up with his enemy and handle the thing face to face, so he resorts to court. Court fails, either because court finds against him, or because his enemy won't go to court, or he doesn't want to go to court. Then he bites the horse's ankle, and he brings the rider down back. It would appear, therefore, that Dunn is the master politician. And the art of politics, in fact, is developed by weak people. The same as a person who can't see, a blind person develops a very powerful sense of smell. And a person who can't hear develops a very powerful and accurate eyesight. So a person who doesn't have stature develops a very sharp political skill. And it's one of the big problems of great politicians, of great leaders, that they're sometimes not able to stand up to the political maneuvering of little people. And that's perhaps one of the reasons that we don't have leadership of stature in the world today. Because the little fox terriers get them all and pull them down. And you're just left with a fox terrier for a leader. That's all you can find. There are very few countries where one actually has the semblance of meaningful leadership and the leadership of stature. And that seems to be done. Dan was the first of the Bnei Ashpotot. He was the first son who was not a son of Leah or Rachel. And it's possible that he felt inferior and that it was rubbed into him a little bit. But one wouldn't be able to say such a thing without a smach from Chazal. But the Medrash says, in Kitisa, Parsha Mem, Omer Rabbi Chanina ben Pazi, Ein lecho gogol mishevet Yehuda. There is no tribe as great in stature as Yehuda. Remember how Yehuda handled Yosef, who he thought was Paro. Altogether we find Yehuda, how he takes responsibility for his own actions. A man of tremendous stature, tremendous independence, willing to stand up and face his foe face to face, to deal with him, negotiate with him, threaten him if necessary. But he doesn't talk to ankles, he talks to faces, Yehuda. Ein lecho gogol mishevet Yehuda, there's nobody as great as the tribe of Yehuda. The ein lecho yorud mishevet Dan. And there was nobody so low down as the tribe of Dan. Dan was actually the lowest down. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, God, Yovoi v'yizdavig loy, they should get married together, Yehuda and Dan should get married together, they should make a team. Shelo Yehu mevazin oito, so that Dan should never feel embarrassed. V'shelo Yehu odom ruchei goso olovim, so that nobody from Yehuda should feel too proud. So they make a good team. Lepi she'agodol v'akot m'shovim lifnei amotim, because the great and the small are equal to God. This is Midrash telling us. Dan was small. He was small in stature, not small in numbers. He actually developed into one of the biggest of the Shvatim. But he was small in stature. How does the Midrash say that in front of God it makes no difference if you're big or small? It makes no difference if you're big or small as long as you're using your abilities correctly. A man who's blind is great in smell. A man who's deaf is great in eyesight. And he can use that strength to make him much greater than an average person. So a Dan, in order to develop a political skill, has to be Yorud. He has to be the most inadequate feeling, the one feeling most inadequate of all the Shvatim. But we need somebody in Klal Yisrael who does have sophisticated political skills. And it's Shovin Lifnei Amotim, it makes no difference. So he's small and he's political and the only way he can fight is by biting the ankle of the horse. That's all he's got. And that doesn't matter, God doesn't mind that. as long as he is married to Yehuda. A dam who is separate from Yehuda is a dangerous animal. And that's why Yaakov says about dam something which he doesn't say about any of the others. Yishuotecho kivisi Hashem. Says the Rashban, unlike Rashi, what Yaakov is saying is Yishuotecho dam kivisi Hashem. I pray to God that you will be saved dam. Because your strength can pull you right down if you're not careful. Care has to be exercised to see that you're mizdaveg le-Yehuda. You have to always be joined together with Yehuda. That's where you'll find fulfillment. The Medrash, in fact, says that very clearly in Bereishis, in chapter 36, paragraph Yudhet. Omer Rabbi Yeshua ben Nechemya, ilulei shenidbak limiyuchod shebishvotim, were it not that Dan cleaved to the greatest of all the shvotim, even the one judge that emanated from Dan, that was Shimshon, would not have emanated were it not for Dan's close relationship with Yehuda. And in fact, Shimshon's mother was from the tribe of Yehuda. His father was from Dan and his mother was from Yehuda. And the Midrash brings various cases of people who came from that combination. The combination of Yehuda's power, his clarity, his moral stature, and Dan's political conniving ability, which could be used to important effect, provided it's controlled by Yehuda. Why is it so important that it's controlled by Yehuda? Very simply. Politics is the sacrificing of principles for expedience. That's what politics is. It's not nice to bite the ankle of the horse. That's not warfare. A gentlemanly way to do it is to challenge the rider, not to kill the horse. But if you have to, you have to. That's done. If that's the way to get the rider, and I'm not big enough to hit the rider, I'll get the horse. And it doesn't matter that that's not principle, that that's not moral. That will win the war. That's what I want to do. That's politics. And that's what Dan has. The political ability. The ability to maneuver, even if he has to sacrifice principles in the process. That's done. Now, if Dan is tied closely to Yehuda, he's safe. Because Yehuda will send him out on specific missions where it's necessary to fight that at that kind of level. Sometimes one needs to. A man won't come to court. He won't face a moral fight. And the only way you can deal with him is on his level. He has to lay the rules of the game. And you need somebody in Klal Yisrael who is sufficiently skilled at that game to be able to play his game with him. And that's done. But he can only be sent into battle when Yehuda sends him into battle. Because Yehuda will never allow expediency to cloud his moral vision. That Yehuda would never do. And it's Yehuda's judgment who has to put Dan's manipulative ability into play. But let Dan go on his own, says the Midrash, the one judge who came from Dan would never have been produced were it not for his relationship with Yehuda. So we understand that this young man who we've got in our Sedra today comes from a risky tribe. Comes from a tribe with a risky background. He comes from the most politically active of all the tribes. That could be a tremendous strength. If he ties himself to a Yehuda type of person, it could make him very strong. But if he doesn't, it can make him very weak, it can destroy him. That's done. That's the wide background from whom he comes. What about his mother? His mother's name was Shlomit. Says Rashi because she used to say shalom to everybody. She used to had a word to everybody. She was speaking to everybody. I don't know if any of you had the opportunity of voting in the last election at the time when the candidates were at the voting booth. They got a word for everybody. Hello to everybody. It makes no difference who you are, where you are, whether they'll ever see you again. They couldn't care less. As long as there's a chance you might vote for them. And there's a hello for everybody. That's Shlomit. She's carrying on in the tradition of her tribe. She's a politician. And if she likes you or she doesn't like you, it makes no difference. Hello she'll say to you with a nice big smile on her face and a good handshake too. That's Shlomit. And she's the daughter of Divri. Who's Divri? Says Rashi was called Divri from the word Medaber. He used to talk a lot. Have you ever seen politicians on television? They talk a lot. They've got a lot to say. That's part of their work. They've got to talk. We see that the qualities of Dan have come down consistently through Divri to Shlomis to this young man who stands before us. He has the social ability, he can mix with people, he's got a nice word to say to him, he's smooth, smooth as they come, smooth as a snake. That's how they are. Let's leave him for a moment. And let's go to last night's drosha, because that forms the second part of what we're trying to construct. We discussed last night the fact that the snake represents both Loshon Hara and he represents the Yetzer Hara. He represents that drive in a human being to do things which he wouldn't like to do, the Taiva, and he also represents Loshon Hara. And we discussed whether there was any relationship between the two. And we came to the conclusion that every time one allows one's Yetzer Hara to take expression, every time, in other words, that one does something that one shouldn't do, there's a little bit of Loshon Hara attached to it. There has to be. But Loshon Hara not about another human being. Loshon Hara even about the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. Because how does it work? A human being, as we know, is made up of two parts. And each part has its own dynamics and its own way of working. And they're both working simultaneously, all the time. And they should both be working simultaneously. Our animal system has to be operating all the time, otherwise we can't live. And our spiritual system has to be operating all the time, otherwise we can't progress. The problem is these two systems pull in different directions very often. Very often the animal side wants to feel alive, and it wants to do animal things. At the same time, the spiritual side wants to be alive, and it doesn't want its animal side to do animal things, it would rather do spiritual things. What happens when one does an aveira? One has a tremendous taiva. What can one do? One needs to do it. One just has to do it, and nothing is helping to stop one. One's going to do it. What happens to the spiritual side of one at that moment? That's what we're going to examine tonight. What exactly happens to it? So one does the aveira. How does that work that one does the aveira? Well, it starts off that you have a taiva. It starts off that you want it. And that want becomes a need. And after all, Freud said that you must give in to your needs because it's perfectly natural. Everybody does a must, and it's unnatural and very bad to frustrate those needs. So you're sure that God understands. Then you think for a moment, but after all, God says he doesn't understand. God says no. Well, you go through the process backwards and forwards. Eventually you convince yourself that in this particular instance, it's not a terrible thing. Under the circumstances, it's not so bad. And the God fool says no. We'll take it further. Let's say you do the Aveira. Once you've done an Aveira once, it becomes easier to do the second time. You do the second time, the third time, the fourth time, the fifth time, and it's an Aveira which you would never have done a month ago. And now it goes easy. No problems anymore. And then you stop and you ask yourself, you convince yourself that it's not that bad, and it's not terribly wrong, and it's not quite like it. It's not the end of the world. My God says no. That creates a problem. Either you're right or God's right. If God's right, you're doing wrong. That's something nobody likes to admit. So we must assume that we're right. But if we're right, then God's playing some funny game with us. And that's how the Yetzer Hara works. And we saw that in Bereishis with the first Aveira. God tells Adam, don't eat from the tree. Adam tells Chava, don't touch the tree. He wants Chava to stay even further away from it than that. The snake comes to Chava and says, come, let's have a meal. There's a beautiful tree there that will make you very clever. Says Chava, I'm not allowed to touch it. The snake pushes Chava against the tree. Says, you see, you touched it, and what happened? Chava didn't know that there was no prohibition in touching the tree. She only knew that she thought that you weren't allowed to touch the tree. The snake knew that the prohibition was only eating the tree, and that if she touched the tree, nothing would happen. So he pushed her against the tree, and nothing happened. He says, you see, there's nothing wrong. It's not so bad. Did it hurt? Are you dead? So start with all this fear business, and start to enjoy life a little bit. What did God put you here for? He put you here to experience everything. Do you think God would have put such a wonderful tree in the Garden of Eden if he didn't want you to experience from it? Is there anything in the world which God puts for some other reason other than that you should experience it? Human being in his life has to have a little taste of everything. However, don't you agree with that? She says, you know, what you're saying makes sense, it's right. But God said no. Do you think he's just playing games? No, I mustn't touch it, although there's nothing wrong with it. Says the snake, sure. Not just is he playing games, but God is, you know, he's only human. He knows that when you eat it, you're going to become very clever. You'll be like God, knowing good and bad. And God doesn't want any competition. He likes to be autocratic and dictatorial. He doesn't want anybody to get anywhere near his level. So he tells you not to touch it. But you don't have to hold yourself back because of God's inadequacies and God's hang-ups. You have to hold yourself back, Father. And that process has to be gone through every time one does an aveva. Because basically you're having to say somewhere, you're either living with a terrible conflict, or you're having to say somewhere that you don't have to take God quite as seriously as you used to take him. He'll understand. There's one thing that saves us from total destruction, because such a thing, if one starts with that, it becomes a terrible thing. And one sees that the whole procedure, the whole process here, the process is, you want to do it. Once you want to do it, you'll justify that it's the right thing to do. Now you've only got one shiloh. God said no. You get rid of God. It can also be done. A word of Lashon Hara and he's gone. It's amazing that even about God one can talk Lashon Hara. That's why I said, what they teach you at school, that sticks and stones can break your bones, but words cannot harm you, it's not right. The words of the snake is what harmed Chava. The Lashon Hara she listened to about the Ribono Shel Olam, that was what made her do the Aveira. You can talk Lashon Hara about the greatest of the greatest of the great, and you can bite the ankle of that horse, and he falls down backwards, not only sideways or frontwards, he falls down totally helplessly, flat on the ground. You've done him in, and you're just a little snake, nothing. Can be done. One word of Lashon Hara can bring down the greatest. And that's what we do in order to justify ourselves all the time. We bring them down. Where's the end of that? Why don't we then go around murdering and doing all sorts of terrible things, justifying it all along the way? There's one thing that really holds us back. If I said to you, if you said, look, you're planning to do such and such an aveira, and I said, right, tell me just before you're about to do it. And you say, right, you come, I'm about to do it. And I say, before you do it, come with me. And we come here to Shul, we come to the Beis HaMedrash, and I stand you in front of the Oren Kodesh, and I open the doors of the Oren Kodesh and the curtains of the Oren Kodesh, and I say, now put your hand on one of these Sifrei Torah, and you do. And I say, I want you now to say clearly the name of the Ribono Shel Olam, but not as we always say it, as it's printed, Yud Kei Vov Kei. Pronounce that name clearly with your hand on the Sefer Torah, and then spit at the Sefer Torah and curse, and then go and do your Aveira, because that's what you're doing, it's the same thing. We couldn't do it. That we couldn't do. To take God's shame on the Feirush, and in the same sentence to desecrate that name, that we couldn't do. Somebody who taught me a lot in business told me that when you're trying to test a concept in business, test it with an extreme case, a crazy extreme case. Because then you'll understand clearly all the ramifications, and then you come back to your normal case. But if you start with a normal case, the differences can be so subtle that you'll miss them. And the person is busy doing a little aveira here, a little aveira there. He doesn't quite appreciate the ramifications of what he is in fact doing. But when you say, come in front of the shul, and you dramatize it clearly, and you say in one sentence, mention the most holy word there is, the name of the Ribono Shel Olam, and in that same sentence, desecrate that name. That we can't do. We stop at that. And if we would go through that procedure each time we're about to do an Aveira, we wouldn't do the Aveira. If we understood that that's what the Aveira is, we don't want to do. That's what we do. And if we only understood that that's what we're doing, it would be a little bit more difficult to do the Aveira. But it's more subtle than the little Averus. We don't notice it that clearly. And we justify in the word of Lashon Hara to ourselves and our minds, and the Ribono Shel Olam is out of the way, and the Avera can be done. Our friend in the Sedra has fallen below that even. The background is, there are two views as to what happened to him. The one view is that he wanted to live among the people of Dan. The people of Dan didn't want him to. And he went to Moshe on a court case. Right? Then he comes from Dan. So he went to court. He went to the law. And he lost. He came out cursing the Ribbono Shel Olam. The other view is that he was mocking the Torah. He was mocking the dinim that came before. These laws of Shabbos with the Lechem Aponim. He was making light of that. Somebody came to him and said, look, you're making light. Why are you making light? Let's understand, why is he making light? The truth, why is he really making light? He's really making light because his father is an Egyptian. His father being an Egyptian, and Egyptians were the biggest Baalei Taiva you can imagine. They had tremendous Taivas, tremendous Yetzirahs. They were hedonists to the extreme. He comes, he's an Egyptian father. And what kind of an Egyptian father? You might say maybe his father was an exception. His father was no exception, because his father was an officer in the army of Paro that was serving, that had control over the Jews, and he took a fancy to Shlomit. So he got rid of Shlomit's husband, didn't kill him, he just made him very busy one day or one night, and gave him a job of work to do far away from home, and he went and spent the night with Shlomit, and this fellow was born from that relationship. It was then Shlomit's husband who came to complain against this man, and it was this man then who started hitting Shlomit's husband just as Moshe was walking past, and Moshe killed the man, the father of this young man that we're talking about. That's his background, that's his story. A man with such a tither. What do you do with such a tither? How do you justify? How do you live? So you must say that you've got to start diminishing the Torah. See, the problem is that when you diminish something, you've got to diminish all the things that are attached to it as well. It's very difficult. You know, if you're learning, if you're crazy enough to say, look, Rashi's talking rubbish, you don't understand Rashi. And apart from the idiocy of saying that about Rashi, how do you explain that the Vilna Gaon learnt that same Rashi and he understood it? And Rabbi Kiva Egel learned the Rashi and he understood it. You were the first person to discover that Rashi doesn't make any sense. If you want to throw the Rashi out, you've got to throw the Vilna Gaon out, and you've got to throw Rabbi Kiva Egel out, and you've got to throw all the Gedolei Achronim out. Anybody who's there didn't have a problem, you've got to throw out with the Rashi. You can't just isolate and throw a certain part out. If you're going to find that this is not acceptable, then everything around it becomes unacceptable too. If this young man is a big Baal Taiva, as he must have been coming from his father, how did he justify all the Aveiros he must want to do? So he's got to make light of Torah. So he mocks about the laws of Shabbos. You see that it's all nonsense. It's out of date. It doesn't apply anymore. Some of the laws are very fine and humanistic, but these kind of ritualistic laws doesn't apply anymore. That's what a guy like this has to do in order to live with himself. Or according to the other interpretation, a man goes to court. He's from Dan, so he goes to court. What happens when he loses? He's not capable of accepting that that's the halacha now. Too bad. That's what it is. That's the right thing to do now, is to follow the judgment. He's got to carry on making mockery. Who do you make mockery of? Firstly, the person who passed him the law, which was Moshe. You know, if you're making mockery of Moshe, you've got to make mockery of the law he was using, which is God's law also. Somebody came to him, the Jewish man came to him and said, you know, take it easy. You can't talk like that about the Torah and about Moshe, because next you'll be talking like that about God. So he talked like that about God too. The obvious consequence, the obvious sequence of events. Where do you stop off otherwise? And then there's no hope for him at all. A person who in public is prepared in one sentence to mention the Shema Meforash and to curse it immediately afterwards, there is nothing whatever that can stop him doing anything. That's a man who will do what he wants. He has distorted his mind to such an extent that he's prepared to sacrifice anything, any principle. God himself is prepared to sacrifice just so that he should be free to do what he wants. And such a man has to be killed. Such a man has no place in the Jewish people, and in fact it would be very harmful to leave him there. Because now at least he hasn't done anything major, anything of major damage. Some damage he's done. But leave him there and he'll be going on and on, doing worse and worse. How did he come to this? Because of his background. From Dan, without a Yehuda. He's from the family of Dan. Not only does he have a Yehuda, but he has a bit of Egyptian blood thrown into him. That means he has strong tithers, he has a strong passion, and the ability to justify and reason and politic and manipulate. That's what he's got. He's a combination of Dan with an Egyptian. Dan on his own is dangerous, unless he's with Yehuda. An Egyptian on his own is even more dangerous. Take an Egyptian and put him together with Dan to produce this man. He doesn't have much hope. But still we are accepting he was a member of the community. He was part of Klal Yisrael. No problem. You can't throw a man out just because he has bad background. But when he gives expression to that bad background, you know there's no hope. When he goes so far beyond where anybody else would go, you realize that there is nothing which holds this man back. He's prepared to kill the Ribbono Shel Olam in order to be allowed to do what he thinks is right. That's what he's prepared to do. This is a very difficult thing to understand, and a very relevant thing to understand, as I'll show you a moment also from a Sedra in 2 weeks' time. But it's relevant particularly to a lot of discussion that's been going on in the Beis HaMedrash, which is positive discussion. Some of it I've been involved in, and some of it I haven't. Somebody was telling me this afternoon that the discussion, we were discussing a certain film, one of these candid camera things. What's the principle of candid camera? The principle of candid camera is how much can you get away with? On the basis that people assume you're normal. That's really what it is. So you know what candid camera does, they... all sorts of funny things, do crazy weird things, put you in a very embarrassing position, but if you're going to challenge the man who comes in as part of candid camera, you're going to be accusing him of being abnormal. And people find a certain amount of difficulty in deciding to what extent they've got to give the man a cheskas normality, just assume that he has a chazaka of being normal, and therefore probably what he's saying is right, I must be the idiot. And when it reaches the point where it's not, he's lost his chazal period. This man is mad. And one of the cases they were talking about was a man who advertises a flat for rent, and people start coming to see the flat, and there's a toilet in the lounge. And people say, what's the toilet doing in the lounge? And he starts explaining the advantages of having the toilet in the lounge. It's the right place, in fact. It's not his fault that everybody else does, and puts the toilet in the back. And he explains and tries to convince people that in fact it's a wonderful bargain. And there's no extra price even. You can get the toilet in the lounge for the same price as other flats that don't have that wonderful advantage. And actually one woman bursts into tears. She just can't handle it. And the discussion goes very far, because the discussion really, that particular discussion developed to the question, what happens? I've often told you that it's tremendous, it's amazing to what extent a Talmud is in the hands of a teacher, particularly in Torah, where so much of it is Torah Shebaal Peh, so much of it has been handed down, so much of it is interpretation, so much of it is a feeling of what's right and what's wrong. A lot of it can be proved, but you can prove this way and you can prove that way. In Halacha it's relatively easy to prove. In Hashkofe, in matters of outlook and philosophy, it's virtually impossible to prove. So where do you get it from? You get it from your teacher, and if your teacher's you wrong, then you're in trouble. And you know the famous story of Hillel, where the convert comes to him and says he wants to learn Torah, but he wants to learn only what can be proved. He wants nothing, none of this business of the kind of Torah which is subject to explanation and interpretation and speculation, no philosophy, just what can be proved. And Hillel says, okay, he realizes already who he's dealing with. And he starts, teaches him on the first day, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, right. Off he goes. Comes back the next day for his second lesson, and he'll start, he says, now what did I say was the first letter of the alphabet? And the guy has done his swatting, and he says, you said Aleph. He said, oh, you'll never make it. I told you Taf is the first letter of the alphabet. What comes after Taf? The guy's getting a bit confused. He says, Beis. So the guy, so Hillel says, no, not Beis. Shin comes after Taf. What's wrong with you? And after Shin comes Reish, and after Reish comes Kuf, and after Kuf comes Tadi. And the guy says, I'm confused. I'll put my life on it that yesterday you told me the other way around. I said, Hillel, so which do you know is right? Maybe yesterday's was right, maybe today's was right. So you have to trust me. Now stop with this business that you only want what can be proved. Nothing can be proved. I can mislead you from beginning to end if I want to, and I can teach you the thing backwards and you won't know the difference. Or I can teach it to you properly and you're either going to trust me and learn or get out. That's basically what happens. So this discussion that I've just told you about develops along the lines, when does one start assuming one has a problem? A rabbi says something. A rabbi teaches something. It sounds wrong. Like a toilet in the middle of the lounge. Sounds wrong. But who says my feelings are right? Who says that it doesn't sound wrong because I come from some crazy Western background and I've got these twisted sense of ideas and values and feelings? Probably he's right. At what point do you carry on trusting him until you find that he's teaching you all sorts of rubbish and you're following it just because you don't have confidence in your own sense of judgment? And one has to be very careful in understanding the whole thing. And I want to explain the answer to that particular question because it's very important to understand. Firstly, a rov's business is not to make people agree with him. If a rov tries to make people agree with him, then he should be in a communist brainwashing organization. That's what that is. There's no reason why everybody should agree with him. They're shivim ponim latova. Within the Torah itself, there are many different styles and many different approaches, and they're all okay, they're all accurate. Different people find that they prefer different approaches. But why should any rov try and impose a uniformity, a tremendous uniformity among people? The only thing a rov is ready. Ready means a teacher. All he can try and do is teach. That's all. And I always say, I ask one thing, that you should understand what I say. It doesn't matter if you agree or not. The highest level of Torah observance, and knowing God and deliberately rebelling against him, is the lowest level of rishus. How can these be included in one statement, in lo tishmu li? Rav Leib Chassman asks the question, and he gives an answer there, but the way we've developed it, the answer is very simple. To be amelim b'Torah, well, let's start the other way around. If you're not going to be amel b'Torah, you're not going to sweat over Torah. What does that mean, sweating over Torah? That means you understand something, you sweat until you do. That's amel b'Torah. Amel b'Torah isn't how many pages you did in a day, and how fast you managed to read, and how many mesechtas you finished. That's not amel. That's also good. That's hasmoda. But amel b'Torah is when you hit something you don't understand, which happens very often, that you sit and work and work and work until you understand it. That's amel b'Torah. If you're not going to do that, inevitably there are going to be parts of Torah you won't understand. Because lo yogatiu matati al tamin. If a person says, I didn't work terribly hard, but I understand what the Torah says. Al tamin, don't believe him, it's a lie. It's not possible to understand the Torah without working hard. So if you don't work hard, and you think you understand, you don't really understand. Which means there are going to be parts of the Torah which you find beyond comprehension. You find them either beyond comprehension in the sense that they don't make any sense, or that you don't agree with them. Because you haven't understood them accurately, because you haven't worked hard enough. That's inevitable. You're going to come across things in Torah that make no sense to you. So what are you going to do then? The Ribbono Shel'olam wrote it. How are you going to answer that? Like the snake. The Ribbono Shel'olam knew he had a bad day when he was writing that. He didn't mean it quite like that. I don't know. It's not everything that Ribbono Shel'olam says is relevant to me. It's not. So I don't understand it. It's not the end of the world. And you move on. In other words, letting up, relaxing on Amel B'Torah must inevitably result in a diminution of the stature of the Ribbono Shel'olam. Otherwise you can't live with yourself. And contrarywise, if you accept that the Ribbono Shel'olam is it and this is his word, you'll toil and toil until you understand. Because you won't be able to say it's not relevant to me. The whole Torah is relevant to me. And you won't be able to say, but I don't understand it. You've got to understand it. So you'll toil until you do. And if you say that, I know God, but there are parts of the Torah which are very beautiful, there are parts of the Torah which are very relevant, and there are parts which, if I don't understand, it won't make terribly much difference. If you're prepared to compromise your vision of God to that point, your Amel B'Torah is gone.
Because whenever you come across something you don't understand, you say, this is one of the pieces that I told you about. But it's not terribly important to understand, and you move on. That's how it is. So, Omal b'Torah, working hard in Torah, and Makiris Riboino, Umiskavin Limroid Boy, are very closely linked. Let's go back to the earlier problem of normal interpersonal relationships. It's the same thing. If you start off with the assumption that the man is trying to sell you the flat is mad, then you mustn't even talk to him. Then you're in the wrong place. What are you sitting and negotiating with a madman about a toilet in a lounge? It doesn't make any sense, and you should pack your bags and go. If you're prepared to talk to him, it means you're assuming that he's normal. If you're assuming that he's normal, then you've got to assume that what he's saying is sensible. And that puts you in a predicament, because what he's saying is that it's good to have a toilet in the lounge. And that doesn't make sense to you. If it doesn't make sense to you, that's a warning bell. Stop. And now apply the full might of your intellect to figure out what's wrong with his argument. And if you can't, then go to others who are cleverer than you and say, this is what that man says. Sounds wrong to me. Can you help me satisfy myself intellectually that he's talking rubbish? If one can't do that, one doesn't know where one stands. And it's really the same thing here. When one's learning from somebody, you've got to assume that what he's teaching you is Torah. If what he's teaching you is Torah and you're not a Makiris Ribono, you're Miskavin Limroid, then it means you accept that the Ribono Shalom has stated this Torah and you've got to understand it. You'll never be able to accredit a person with exactly the amount of intelligence he's got. It's not possible to measure people's intelligence absolutely. And by intelligence, I'm using now the word in its biggest sense, not just intelligence in terms of IQ, but intelligence in terms of having access to emeskat. That either through his reasoning or what he's learned or whatever it is, a man who's got access to emeskat. Now, you'll never be able to measure that exactly. You've either got to credit him with a little bit more than he's got or with a little bit less than he's got. If you credit him with less than he's got, you run the risk that as soon as you hit something that doesn't feel right, you drop it. And that's the danger in learning Torah. Because we grow out of those things that don't feel right. We grow in one of two ways. Either we find that in fact we're correct, and we reject with our intellect what has been put to us. That's growth. Because it doesn't feel right, I've been able to find in fact that it isn't right. And I can prove that it isn't right. And one rejects. That's tremendous intellectual growth. Or one grows emotionally. You find, it doesn't feel right. But on an intellectual basis, I've gone through the sources and everything, I've discussed it with other people, it is right. That means my feelings are wrong. And my feelings need readjustment. But that's omal, that's terribly hard work. When something is put to you that you don't like, the work of either disproving it, or of accepting it and molding one's feelings according to it, that's omal, that's the omal of Torah. And the tendency is simply to say, I'm shugas. Leave it alone, it's not serious. And that's the Miskaven Limroid boy. In other words, what I'm saying is, use a feeling as an indication that something needs investigation or adaption. If you feel wrong about it, either your feeling is wrong or your understanding is wrong. In any event, it needs either further investigation to reject it, or it needs an adaption of your feelings. But don't choose on the basis of feeling right and wrong. Because if one's choosing on that basis, growth becomes impossible. Development becomes impossible. So we're back to what I said, that no Rav expects people to agree with him. That's not important. All he expects is that you understand. But to understand something new, to understand something deep, if it's Torah, is going to require tremendous omal from you. And that omal can only be engaged in if the provisional assumption is that the stuff is emes. If the provisional assumption is it might or might not be emes, who's going to worry about giving it the time and effort that it really needs in order to understand it? Just before we finish off, I had an interesting discussion with somebody who comes to the shiur, and I don't think that he'll object to my quoting from the discussion, because I felt particularly honored that we could have such an open discussion about the shiur. And he basically said in a very polite and sensitive way that he thinks that the Motzei Shabbos Shiurim are nonsensical. And I say I felt honored that we could do this in that particular way. And I said, okay, I understand that. No problem with that. But tell me, how do you explain then that other people take the trouble on the Motzei Shabbos, which is not an a convenient time? They come, they sit, and they listen in a hot, stuffy room. How do you explain that? I said, I can understand that too. Never, they're not very intelligent people. I said, but Lemaisa, what do you do? There are a couple of intelligent people, so-and-so, so-and-so. They're clearly intelligent people. And not only do they come, but they revise the shul, and they work over the shul, and they talk over the shul. He said, with absolute honesty, and he's right, because this has to be the sequence of discussion, if that's the attitude that one takes towards anything. A little bit like we said last night, the Rambam can also make a mistake. Everybody has mishugas. Why I'm using this as an illustration and what I want you to appreciate and why I don't believe that he'll feel bad by my using this illustration to you. Because it's something that everybody is battling with. That everybody's busy talking about and trying to come to terms with. If you're going to discard part of it, you've got to discard an awful lot together with it. You can't pick out a little bit. This Rashi, I don't understand, stick that away. Okay, it's not relevant. You can't do that. The Torah has a shleimus to it. And one has to face all the problems that are going to result from discarding. One can't discard just because it doesn't sound right. Certainly there's nothing wrong in saying it doesn't sound right. And I sweated and toiled over it. And I'll tell you why it doesn't sound right. A, because this. B, because of the Gemara on such and such a page which says the opposite. C, because 6 months ago you said the opposite. D, because this, etc., etc. That there's nothing wrong with. That's education. That's learning and that's growth. But not just sitting at a side altogether. And that's the chiddush in Bechukosai. That the two, in terms of our relationship to Torah, setting God aside and sweating over Torah, are the same thing. Because if you're going to sweat over Torah, you'll never set God aside. And if you're going to set God aside, you'll never sweat over Torah. We see from here that when one does an Avera, when one allows that sort of animal dynamics in one to take over, we ask at the beginning, what is the other side doing at that moment? What is the spiritual side doing at that moment? The normal understanding is it's dormant. This time my animal side becomes dominant, my spiritual side is dormant. When I do a mitzvah, my spiritual side is dominant and my animal side is dormant. It's not true. When one does an Avera, one takes one's spiritual side and one twists it and distorts it and buries it. And that's the Avera. That's what's so terrible about it. Quite apart from the inherent wrong of the Avera, what's wrong is that if one's an honest person, one has to twist one's intellect to be able to justify doing the Avera. Maybe not consciously, maybe you don't go through the argument, but every Avera, no matter how small, if you're basically a believer in God and the Torah, every Avera requires the snake's argument. You've got to explain somehow if the Avera isn't so bad, why did God say no? You've got to explain God away somehow. And that's the sore part of the Avera. That one takes the spiritual side and one actually spoils it. One damages it in order to justify what one's doing. And on the other hand, when one does a mitzvah, the opposite happens. One takes that animal part of one and one actually subjects that to one's intellect. One basically says, look, snake, you're right. I touched the tree and it didn't hurt. And I'm sure it's delicious to eat. And I'm sure it will make me very clever and a very great person. But God said no. The only thing I know for certainty in this world, snake, is that God knows what he's talking about. Everything else is doubtful. Because I've seen people prove all sorts of funny things. And I've seen all sorts of illusions. I don't know where I stand, snake, except for one thing. And that's that what God says is right. I've never caught God out. And that's the axiom from which I move. One has to have one constant. You have to have something in your formula of life which doesn't change. And everything else does change. The one thing which one must move in the world with the solidarity of this one thing is that the Ratzon Hashem is right. That's it. Once the Ratzon Hashem is right, it doesn't mean that I must go around like the automate, just doing what he says. That's not what that means at all. But once I accept that the Ratzon Hashem is right, I'll break heaven and earth to understand why it's right. And that's what learning Torah is.
Once one's accepted that God knows what he's talking about, now I've got to try and understand why. But if we don't accept that first thing, then the whole system of Torah collapses. And that really is the meaning of Na'aseh v'Nishma. We'll do irrespective. Why will we do? Because God said so. And we can't operate in the world, it's just not practical to operate in the world unless we accept that axiom. You start off in mathematics and they teach you some axioms and you say, prove them, they say, forget about it. The whole thing is built on this. If you don't accept these, there's no mathematics. So you accept and you move on. This has to be accepted at the outset. Later on you can prove it to yourself, but at the outset it has to be accepted. The Ritzon Hashem is right. God knows what he's talking about. That's all. God's not crazy. God's not unintelligent. And God's not out to fool us and to trick us. He's out to tell us what's right and what's wrong, and that I accept. And then Nishma. Once I've accepted that, I'm going to apply myself to figure out why he says this is good and why he says this is bad and why this is better than that and this is worse than that and why if I'm in a position A, B, C, I've got to do it. I'll try and understand. But I start off by accepting that it's right. This is a limud which applies not only to one's Torah, but to anything one desires to understand. If you desire to understand something, if you're listening to a piece of music, or you're looking at a painting, just ask yourself first, are you reading a book? Or you're listening to a lecture? Or your wife is talking to you, or your husband is talking to you, or your children are talking to you. Children, it's very important in that very communication. Ask yourself at the beginning of the relationship, at the beginning of the whole experience, do I want to understand it or don't I? And if I want to understand it, am I prepared to put some effort into understanding it? Is it worth it? If it's not worth it, drop it right away and go into something more worthwhile. We don't have enough time in life to spend time on things that aren't worthwhile. If you've decided it's worthwhile to understand, then start off from the assumption that what is being communicated to you is correct, it's right, there's something worthwhile in it. Comes from somebody who's thought it out. If it sounds wrong afterwards, criticize it intellectually. Pull it to pieces. Show yourself where it's wrong. Have the skills to be able to do that. But don't just turn off because it doesn't sound nice to you. Because then you're not being honest to yourself. If your original decision was, I want to understand, then carry that right through. And don't turn off because it's beginning to get difficult. If a child is talking to you, treat what the child is saying seriously, in order that you should understand what the child is saying. If you find afterwards it's nonsensical, then make sure that you are sure that it's nonsensical and that you can persuade the child it's nonsensical. But don't reject it just because it sounds different. And don't reject anything just because it sounds different, if you believe it's worthwhile following it through. And this we'll find is the greatest area of growth. As one copes with life and comes across things which seem strange and different and new, with chidushim, and one sorts them out after giving them all due seriousness, one's able to sort them out into those things we reject, into those things we partially accept, and into those things that we totally accept. We find that through that the growth occurs and our whole manipulation of the world, our understanding of the world changes, and we're able to reach tremendous levels. The problem is that we're hit by this son of the Egyptian man and the Jewish woman are problems which we need not suffer from. If we're prepared to face things squarely and not work like the snake at the foot of the horse. If we don't have a tither like the Egyptian had, just ordinary Jewish tithers, which are also pretty healthy, just not of the same magnitude as an Egyptian. That means we're prepared, if necessary, to subject those tithes to our intellects. And we're prepared to work intellectually properly. And the foundation upon which our intellects operate is that the Ribbono Shel Olam knows what he's talking about. If we can work from that basis, we'll find tremendous excitement in discovering new things and in discovering a strength in directing ourselves and controlling ourselves that we never knew we had.